Our fifth case for argument this morning is Negrete against National Railroad Passenger Corporation.
Good morning. Excuse me, if it pleases the court. My name is Joseph Tai. I represent the plaintiff. As appellate counsel, I come to this engagement with full and fair warning that I face, as this court has said repeatedly, an uphill, which fortunately is not an up-cliff struggle, but it's an uphill struggle. I have a record that is the record that it is.
Struggle. Did the district judge refer your client to the U.S. Attorney for prosecution for perjury?
No, I do not believe
so. Perhaps we should.
I do not believe that would be.
Your brief is quite candid that he was a perjurer. It's only a question of what the right remedy is.
Well, I think the brief is candid that he made a statement at his deposition that was not an accurate statement. I don't know that I have admitted him to all the elements of the federal offense of perjury, Your Honor, but I think the heart of Your Honor's question is the heart of my appeal. What do we do when we have a situation where there is
a plaintiff who perjures himself in discovery? You dismiss the case and refer the case to the U.S. attorney. One should think that's the two normal steps.
And having read the 18 cases that the two sides have cited before this court, I respectfully come to a different conclusion. The cases that have been discussed by the parties in this case all related to efforts by the part of a party to subvert the legal system as to a central issue in the case. This is an FVLA case where the plaintiff's rental income from an apartment building is not relevant to his claim of damages. The relevant factual inquiry that we had conceded in our reply brief would be, to the extent that the plaintiff was able to do physical work that he otherwise in the past had engaged others to do, which would go to the question of the severity of his injury or to the question of whether he was malingering because he was obtaining a financial advantage by virtue of not working, in that he was able to devote his time to other matters.
Look,
the question of his rental income, however, is not germane to that question.
What is germane, Mr. Tai, is that Mr. Negrete's discovery transgressions were very serious, and there was a pattern to them. He seems to have reportedly hid information that was inconsistent with his claim of disability, and there was foot dragging, omissions. He constantly failed to disclose information, and all of that shows a pattern and supports an inference of willfulness or bad faith. I mean, what we have here, I'm afraid, is serious misbehavior that was aimed at obstructing the truth-seeking process, and that's why the case was dismissed.
Your Honor, when I read the record in this an appeal, I was struck first, as I'm sure the court was, by the pace or the absence of pace that the information was being disclosed and the efforts that the railroad had undertaken to secure compliance with fairly routine discovery matters. And I was completely able to appreciate the level of frustration that the railroad expressed. And frankly, I understand the frustration of the magistrate judge and the district court over the manner by which the discovery had proceeded. But those issues, I respectfully suggest, do not established that he was willfully trying to defeat the system or prevent the system. It shows an inadequate attention to the need to move the case on the part of counsel. It shows a lack of attention to responsiveness on the part of the plaintiff, but not, I think, an effort to use the legal system to an untoward purpose or to just have a case hanging out there and then I'm entitled to come into court no matter what. The information was slow in coming. Clearly, that is undeniable. Some of the information that was missing, I believe, is the type of factual discrepancies that will arise in almost any case, not knowing the name, for example, of a second MRI place, when even the doctor who sent you there doesn't have it in his records that he sent you to the MRI. Well, the RRB records, for example. I don't know where a plaintiff sees an advantage or his team sees a potential advantage in hiding that kind of information. So I have a hard time drawing the inference that there was this object behind this behavior when I think instead it's more likely that the legal system and the defendant were not served with the level of responsiveness and attention that they are warranted, for which some sanctions would be appropriate.
But how do you explain a deposition in which a plaintiff gives testimony about the number of buildings that he owns and says he owns one building when he actually owns three? How does a judge look at something like that as anything but a deliberate falsehood? I mean, you know, unless he's mentally unbalanced or has Alzheimer's.
Well, Judge, at the time of his deposition, he has already disclosed the existence of three apartment buildings in his tax returns. That is one of the problems that I have with the case as appellate counsel in looking through this, because the information as to the number of the apartments was independently and disclosed prior to the deposition. So I ask myself the question from a different vantage point, and that is, why would someone attempting to subvert the judicial system choose this point on a collateral issue that doesn't relate to his case as the line in the sand at which he is going to try to deceive everybody, as opposed to, as the record suggests, a poorly educated, not particularly intelligent person, not in his native tongue, making a mistake at his deposition when there is independently produced the truthful evidence that would be the evidence that people would want to rely upon in the first place, that what was submitted. And the fact was and is that the existence of those apartment buildings was independently disclosed. He clearly gave incorrect testimony at his deposition.
What about the handling of the records from the Railroad Retirement Board, which is directly related to the claim of disability here?
Yes, Your Honor.
He originally produces 12 pages when the actual complete record is something like 236 pages, and that only comes much later and also contains a report that demonstrates that he's not disabled. What other inference could be drawn from that other than that he was withholding it and attempting to hide it?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I think
And then it's also delivered opened when it was supposed to be delivered sealed.
Yes, the 12 pages was delivered at the first instance independently of the RRB process. The medical records of the plaintiff's treatment were secured by the parties in discovery. The RRB receives a second copy of those medical records as part of the RRB's determination to pay the disability or to recognize the disability. So the records themselves were delivered in the first instance in a direct exchange of information by the healthcare providers. The RRB records would be a compilation of those. I don't think it's a fair or correct conclusion that the RRB records was the only source in which the other medical opinion, which called into question the nature and extent of his claimed disability. I don't think it arises to a disproving of the disability. I think it creates the issue of fact that the defendant seized upon properly, had retained an expert, and was prepared to offer testimony to try before the court. The defendant had an expert who was in a position to offer an opinion as to the nature and extent of the plaintiff's disability before the issue came up as to how to arrange for the delivery of the RRB records. The RRB records, when they were produced, did not give rise to any claim before anybody that there were additional records in that subset.
Judge thought, we have no idea whether the RRB records have ever been produced.
I understand that, Judge, and you know, I can't offer an explanation for how something that would seem so straightforward as a delivery of records could happen, except that the most obvious inference to me is there was a mistake, not an attempt to cheat, as evidenced by the fact that there are all these collateral...
I suppose it's conceivable that a judge would have found that a mistake had there been a record of better performance on your client's part, but I don't see how you can say, as is essential to this appeal, that it was clearly erroneous for the district court to find, in light of your client's other behavior, that this was an effort to cheat.
I think, Your Honor, if it hadn't been for the cases that we discussed in the briefs and the line that I see from those cases as to the level of the target of the misbehavior on the truth-seeking process, that is the basis on which I say that it would be clearly erroneous or inappropriate in this case, because the record itself is the record. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Ms. Jennings.
Good morning, Your Honors. Nobody ever said that Mr. Negrete was a skillful liar. And perhaps his lack of education and sophistication made him not realize that the railroad's lawyer would keep digging, that it would look at this and say, 12 pages can't be the record. And we keep digging and keep digging and keep digging for more and more information. The fact that we ultimately got the information, and let's assume it's correct now, and I don't know that you can make that assumption, doesn't excuse plaintiffs lying. And you can call it factual discrepancy all you want. When you say to somebody straight out, how many do you own any buildings? And he said, yes, one. And he's asked again later, you don't own any other buildings? No, I don't. Just the one. When you ask somebody, how much rent do you get? $450. When he's just signed a receipt recently for $650 for that same apartment. Those aren't the kinds of things that are mistakes.
How do you respond to his point that the investigator's notes concerning the interviews of Mr. Negrete's tenants were not properly authenticated and were not admissible as evidence?
Your Honor, we had no intention of admitting them as evidence. What we were pointing out is that had plaintiffs been successful, had we not continued insisting on more information, we never would have known that those potential witnesses existed. What he was doing was hiding sources of relevant information from us. Whether or not, you know, how a jury would ultimately decide it, they would have had no opportunity to decide the issue because we didn't have those names. If Your Honor have any other questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our final case for argument today is United States.